Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. This half hour on the show, we'll learn about a United States foreign policy that emphasizes global development and diplomacy that seeks to reintroduce America to the world and that focuses on confronting international poverty in the fight against terrorism and extremism. My guest is senior senator from Nebraska, Republican Senator Chuck Hagel. The senator is here in Columbus today as part of a conference originated by the Bipartisan Center for U.S. Global Engagement. Now, the conference focuses on exploring non-military tools of foreign and national security policy, by the way, co-sponsored by the John Glenn School of Public Affairs here and the Columbus Council on World Affairs. Senator Chuck Hagel's new book addresses these very same issues. It's entitled America, Our Next Chapter. Tough questions, straight answers. Welcome to Open Line, Senator Chuck Hagel. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Fred, very much. Actually, I am not in Ohio today. I am still in Washington. We have some weather problems back here.
Oh, my goodness.
So I'm going to address the group today via satellite, and I think that's going to work fine. I'll be able to make my remarks and then engage in a question and answer. So I just thought I would, in the interest of absolute accuracy, which I know you always appreciate, I wanted to let you know I'm not, unfortunately, in Ohio. I'm
okay,
here.
Well, sorry to say, but we'll have the hookup there. Well, by the way, we're at 614-292-8513 if you'd like to ask a question or pose a comment, and you can email comments to openline@wosu.org. Senator Hagel, you said, the world does not know who we are, and you say our next president has to reintroduce America to the world. Now, in what sense do you mean that?
Well, if you just examine the demographics of our world today, almost 6.5 billion people, nearly 40% of that number under the age of 19 years old. This is a world that majority-wise, the citizens alive today were not alive during World War II and after World War II. When America essentially captured the imagination and the recognition of the citizenship of the globe. And our standing in the world was very much predicated on how people saw us after World War II and how we helped lead the world back and rebuild economies and do the things that we have done the last 60 years. But today it's a different kind of world. So if you just start with those demographics, then you further develop down into the numbers and the specifics of those demographics, the areas of the world that were left behind, the most troubled areas of the world, obviously the Middle East, Africa, a good part of Latin America, certainly North Korea, Central Asia. There is where a lot of these people reside who either have a negative attitude about America, who really don't understand it, who we are and have an optic that is not in our interest. And that's why I say, we are going to have to reintroduce to the world who we are, our purpose, in order for us to earn their trust like we have over the last 60 years so that we can once again lead the world in some purposeful way.
How do we go about doing that, Senator? You mentioned the next president is going to have to do some traveling.
Well, I think it's an opportunity as well as a challenge, Fred. I believe, and I am around the world an awful lot and listen carefully and listen to leaders who come here to the United States, I believe the leaders of the world, I believe the people of the world want America to lead again. I think they know that when America is not leading, when America is stumbling or is in some trouble, the world is more dangerous. Now, that doesn't mean they want us to dictate or impose or invade or occupy, but they want us to lead through consensus like we have done for the most part over the last 60 years. And I think they're willing to follow a new president who's honest, who's competent, who's accountable, who brings together a consensus of purpose, defining relationship on our common interests, not on our differences. And I think the next president has that opportunity. It won't be easy, but I think the next president can do that.
Well, has President Bush failed in the task of helping America lead the world?
Well, I think his administration is not going to be a model, as historians review this time, for how to lead the world. I think much of the policies of this administration have been very unilateral, have focused on the optics of America's interests, and not reverse those optics to include a common interest base and a foundation for all nations. I mean, when you look at the issues today, challenges of the world, they're not unique to America. Proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, terrorism, extremism, poverty, energy, environmental issues, they affect all the citizens of mankind. And I think we're going to have to recalibrate those common interests, just and focus on those and build relationships on those common interests, as Truman did, as Eisenhower did, Marshall did, Reagan did, Bush 1 did, Kennedy did. And I don't think this administration has fulfilled the commitment that most American presidents have always focused on.
Have we neglected or, and to some degree, alienated our European allies?
Well, if you look at one measurement of that answer, which is polling data from Gallup, from Pew, from Zogby, from any data information institution, the answer to that is yes. Clearly, we have alienated most of the world, even in the areas where we have had traditionally strong relationships and very close allies, like Turkey and Australia. Those numbers are down in the teens, favorable impressions of the United States. When you further examine those numbers, however, it's not that these people are anti-American, that they're anti-American citizen. They don't like our policies. They think we're pushing them around. They think we're doing things that are not in the interest of the rest of the world. They think we're doing things only in our own interest. Now, great powers are always resented. I mean, that's just part of being a great power. But we should factor that in to our relationships and understand that. Now, that's fair and unfair, but that's the way the world is. We must do a better job of restructuring and recalibrating and refocusing these things, and I think again we can win back the world. But these big issues that we are dealing with today, let's take terrorism for example. America is bogged down in two wars today. Now, we're not going to be successful in dealing with any of these big issues without the rest of the world. These are too big, they're too deep, they're too wide for only one nation to be successful. We need, for example, seamless relationships, intelligence gathering and sharing. That means relationships, that means trade, higher standard of living, dealing with the human condition. And we don't have that responsibility alone. All nations must deal with that. But we have to bring a consensus to that because we are the most powerful nation on earth. And so I think it's a matter of widening our lens and reorienting our scope and the centerpiece of our policies. And again, I think that that's doable, and I think the next president has an opportunity to do that.
You said a pretty stern criticism here. You said that the United States has ricocheted from crisis to crisis rather than having a strategic conceptualizing of a foreign policy. Tell us more about that.
Well, I think that, in my opinion, is exactly what we've done. For example, Iraq. Iraq has never been an issue, can't be an issue, that is compartmentalized or dealt with in some kind of abstraction of isolation. This is a regional issue. This issue in Iraq includes, in fact, all the neighbors. Iran probably is the most influential country in Iraq today. We're not going to help the Iraqis solve any of their problems or bring stability and security prosperity to Iraq without, first of all, the Iraqis wanting that. That's the ultimate decider, but not without Syria, Iran. That spills over into the Palestinian-Israeli issue, Iran's support of Hezbollah and Hamas. That factors in the Egyptian dynamic. Look at Lebanon, which is essentially a non-functioning government. All these things are interconnected. They're interrelated. And what I'm talking about is a regional context that these issues must be dealt with some strategic context, which I don't think we've done. Afghanistan's the same way. When we went into Afghanistan, the Iranians were quite helpful to us in sharing of intelligence and doing a number of things on that western border of Afghanistan. Why was that? I don't think it was because they wanted to help us or they had found a newfound spirit of cooperation necessarily, but it was clearly in their self-interest not to have opium and poppy moving into their into their area, across those borders, having extremism and terrorism on those borders going into Iran, we could have continued to develop that common interest. And that means you have to have a strategic context in which you place using all your instruments of power. The military is but one of those, and we've loaded everything on our military. And just as General Petraeus told us, Senate Foreign Relations Committee a few months ago, there will not be any kind of military solution in Iraq. Well, of course not. There wasn't one in Vietnam. There wasn't one in Algeria. There's not going to be one in Iraq. And so that's what I'm talking about.
Senator, you say we've asked our military to do it all, to be surrogate mayors, surrogate ambassadors, engineers, et cetera, et cetera. Not fair, huh?
Well, that in fact is what we've asked them to do. And our military has performed spectacularly well. They've done everything we've asked them to do and more, and they've done it as well as any set of soldiers we've had in the history of our country, in my opinion. But you can't load all of the burden and the responsibility onto our military. Well, for example, Secretary of Defense Gates gave a speech in Kansas about 3 months ago. It was at the Alf Landon annual lecture at Kansas State, and most of that speech was about using America's soft power, our smart power, our diplomatic power. In fact, he went so far as to say we should increase the budgets for our State Department and our foreign assistance programs, and he made an interesting point. He said, I have more people on a battle carrier group in the Persian Gulf than the State Department has, including all of their professional foreign service officers. Well, that was a very interesting speech coming from a Secretary of Defense, but Secretary Gates was right, and he knows why he gave that speech, because he knows that his department is being asked to do it all. It's not that the State Department and our foreign service officers aren't doing a lot. They are, but they're not doing – they can't do as much as our military, because our military has the budget. You know, our military has a $550,000 budget, but we're also doing great damage to our military because of the way we're handling this. And I think you are quite aware of the kind of damage that we're seeing now coming out as a consequence of these young men and women spending 2 and 3 and 4 tours nonstop in Afghanistan and Iraq. You can't run people like machines or donkeys. It won't work. Mm-hmm. So that's partly what I'm referring to when I talk about the military.
Republican Nebraska Senator Chuck Hagel joins us this half hour. He speaks from Washington by a televideo link to a conference here at The Ohio State University today, sponsored by the Center for U.S. Global Engagement. And the focus of the conference is on exploring non-military tools of foreign and national security policy. My guest's new book is called America, Our Next Chapter, Tough Questions, Straight Answers. We're at 614-292-8513. Let's go to the phones here with Jeff. Hello, Jeff.
Good afternoon, Fred. I won't waste the senator's time by asking him any ridiculous questions, you know, such as his strategic political plans, because that's all up in the air. So I will ask him a question, though, sort of related to it. You work with the two gentlemen that are two great Americans that are running for president in the United States. The next president is going to, as you said, is going to have to reintroduce himself and America to a world that's kind of unfamiliar with us, and we have, I guess, a negative perception to a great extent. How do you think Senator Obama and Senator McCain would differ in their approach in reintroducing themselves to the world?
Well, I don't speak for either one of the senators, and as you noted, I work with both of them very closely. Both of them are good friends. Both are smart. They're capable. One of them is going to be president. I think they are very decent men, and I think they'll be prepared, whichever one is elected president. But I think as we develop the campaign, and already Americans are seeing a different approach from the two candidates, but over the next 4 months, they will be able to lay out their programs, what they believe America needs to do to reorient itself, to restructure itself, what their plans would be to lead the country and lead the world over the next 4 years. And I think we can expect to see some of those ideas and policies developed in very clear specificity. That's what America needs to hear. We need to hear from both of these men as to what they would do and how they would handle these issues and what would be their objective and what kind of foreign policy would they bring to our nation. But I'm not equipped to be able to answer for either one of them or explain where they may take the country. I think, though, that we are seeing that evolve, and we'll see it completely evolve over the next 4 months. That's why we have worse campaigns.
Okay, Jeff, thanks for your call. Senator Hagel, your fellow Nebraskan Ted Sorensen, former speechwriter for President JFK, said that Barack Obama should choose you as his running mate in the vice presidential slot. And according to the Huffington Post, you said you wouldn't rule that out. Is that right?
Well, I appreciate Ted Sorensen's comments, but when I was asked about that issue, I said, first of all, I don't expect any of that kind of activity to occur. I don't expect to be on anybody's ticket this year or next year. I am not seeking a third term in the Senate. I'll be a private citizen come January of next year. So that's what I preface my remarks by saying. The second thing I said is that it obviously any presidential candidate or a president, if he comes to a citizen, in my case, United States Senator, and asks to consider taking a role in a government, a position, you'd have to consider it. I don't think anybody would or could do otherwise. I believe, Fred, this country is in a lot of trouble. I think the next president is going to inherit a set of problems, not unlike what FDR inherited on March 4th, 1933. I think it's that deep and that wide across the board. Economic issues, energy issues, health care issues, entitlement issues, deficits, debt, war. And we're all going to have to come together. This next president is going to have to govern with a consensus to govern. He's going to have to govern and stop the nonsense that both parties have been playing over the last few years. Everything is about a political tactical win. This country's paralyzed. We're locked down. 84% of American people, according to the Washington Post ABC poll last week, says America's going in the wrong direction. Now, that is very dangerous for a country. And all of us, whether you're Republican or a Democrat or an atheist, communist, independent, whatever you claim you are, we've got to pull this country back together and make some tough choices and make some decisions. And so if someone asks any of us to take on a different role, of course you'd have to consider it.
So the next president is going to have to speak with the American people and try to rouse them up to a consensus, right?
He can't govern without doing that. The next president is going to have to bring this country together in some spirit of purpose, some consensus to govern. There'll be differences. There'll be strong debates. There'll be tensions, and there should be. But the next president is going to have to form a bipartisan cabinet, bring in the best people he can find in America, regardless of political affiliation, reach to the Congress, reach to both parties, reach out to America, reach to the world, and say, all right, we're going to fix these problems. Look at the problems that we have. They are immense, and they're deep. And we can't squander another 4 years in this country. If we do, we'll put America in a very, very deep hole. We're in a deep hole right now, and we're in trouble. But I don't think there's a problem that we can't fix. I don't think there's anything we can't get out of. I think we can fix these kinds of things. But not if we keep deferring the tough choices and keep paralyzing our process.
Senator Hagel, you say that in terms of the Middle East, we should engage in talks with Iran with no preconditions whatsoever. What would we talk with them about?
Well, I've said that, and I've said this for some time now, that I think to begin an initial exploration of engaging Iran in an unconditional, comprehensive, direct way is the wisest course of action. Why do I say that? Well, if you believe things are going so well in the Middle East today, then we'll just keep doing what we're doing. But I happen to believe that the Middle East today is more dangerous, more combustible, more complicated than it has ever been. And I would essentially defy anybody to tell me otherwise. And that's measured on what's going on right now in the Middle East. We are about at the brink of a regional explosion in the Middle East. Right now in the newspapers today, talk about and specific incidents of where Israel has been test running 100 airplanes and flights and 900-mile voyages to go attack Iran's nuclear capability areas, which we're not quite sure of where they are or what they have. I've never understood why great powers won't engage. Ronald Reagan engaged. John Kennedy engaged. George Bush Sr. engaged. Great powers engaged. Engagement is not appeasement. Diplomacy is not appeasement. The military option is always there. There are consequences to actions, and I think all we need to do is look at Iraq and start to appreciate some consequences that we never ever thought through very carefully before we got into that mess 6 years ago. And so I think we should be very wise and very careful here in how we handle the Middle East. And again, I believe that the great powers engage and use all the instruments of power. That doesn't mean you get to a negotiation. Maybe we won't. But let's look at what we're doing in North Korea today. If you recall, North Korea was one of President Bush's axis of evils. He said as many bad things about Kim Jong-il as he has done about Ahmadinejad. But what are we doing? Well, we found common interests. We found a consensus with our allies in that part of the world, Russia, China, Japan, South Korea, the six-party talks which we are leading. We've been sitting down and talking to North Korea. We're about ready to see them blowing up one of their water towers at one of their nuclear facilities. We're actually making progress in North Korea. Now, that's engagement. That's talking. And this is to a power that we know has nuclear weapons. We know nuclear weapons exist in North Korea. So why wouldn't we do that or try something like that in Iran, especially when our policy in Iran is failing?
Senator, in the 2 minutes we have left, you've talked about dealing with poverty as one of the root causes of terrorism. That is to say, the despair engendered by poverty. How would we deal with that? What would we do?
Well, again, this is one of these great global issues that America, no nation is big enough, strong enough, wealthy enough to deal with on its own. But until we get to underneath these human conditions and start understanding what drives people to do some of the things they do, I don't connect necessarily terrorism with poverty. But we know that a third of the population of the world today lives in some state of poverty. When man is without dignity, not much else matters. When man is connected to an endless cycle of despair, then something's going to happen there. And these are the people that the really evil people of the world prey on. And they use religion. They use other bizarre philosophies to destroy mankind. These people are very easy prey for that. In those areas of the world, not much good's going to happen. We've got to start working toward the end product here, meaning the human condition. The human condition throughout history has always in the end changed events, and it always dictates outcome of events. And we've got to be wiser than we have been working with the world on this.
Mm-hmm. Senator Chuck Hagel with us for the past half hour. Senator Hagel speaks by teleconference to the Center for U.S. Global Engagement Conference here at The Ohio State University, sponsored with the John Glenn School of Public Affairs and the Columbus Council on World Affairs. Senator Hagel's new book is America, Our Next Chapter, Tough Questions, Straight Answers. Senator Chuck Hagel, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us this morning.
Well, you're generous to give me some time, and I look forward to being with you one of these days in person, but thank you, and I will tell all your fans in Washington hello.
Okay, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
We'll be back after these messages. It's a WOSU 820 NPR News.
Everybody's an expert on their own lives. And on Talk of the Nation, we ask you to share your stories.
These techniques were used on me when I went through resistance training, sleep deprivation, putting bags over our heads.
I'm Neil Conan. Real stories from real people about real issues that matter to you. Join us. Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation begins later this afternoon. It's here from 2 until 4 o'clock, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning, I'm Amy Jurevich. It is 72 degrees at 11:30. Thanks for joining us for Open Line this morning. If you haven't given your financial support to WOSU for the great news and information you hear, now is the perfect time to do so. Call 1-866-897-9678. Your call will help us make our financial goals for this year and make sure the programs you value stay right here on WOSU. Or you can go online to WOSU.org. And thanks. Don't forget that you should start your weekday mornings with Morning Edition, starting at 5 a.m., now on WOSU 89.7 FM.
Support for WOSU comes from Central Ohio's only academic medical center, where research, teaching, and patient care come together to improve people's lives. We are the Ohio State University Medical Center.
Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. We have time here for a bit of a shorter open forum on this Monday. 614-292-8513. What do you think of some of the views espoused by Senator Chuck Hagel? He is the senior Republican, senior senator from Nebraska, Republican, and he says, "Look, he doesn't say we should not use military power in the world. In fact, he's very much in favor of a strong military. He says that's what a great power needs, a strong military. But he says we could use soft power more extensively, international agreements, international concerted actions, diplomacy," he says. And, of course, again, he says, let's talk with Iran without any preconditions. And you remember there was a commission just a short time ago that talked about that and said that that's what we ought to do. And so he says, look, we've engaged in diplomacy with North Korea. We could do the same thing with Iran to our benefit. And then he says also a root cause of the kind of extremism that can lead people to be propagandized toward terrorism is indeed despair. And despair is a part of poverty and hunger and lack of dignity. And he says the United States could do better in concert with other nations around the world in addressing these kinds of problems. He says, look, Hamas and Hezbollah, they gain support in their areas because they address poverty. He said we should not leave the field to groups like Hamas and Hezbollah. And Senator Hagel also supports a call by Iraqi Prime Minister Maliki for a regional conference led by Iraq, a conference and that would include Iran and Syria. And, of course, the senator also said it was a big mistake to some degree alienate our European allies. And he would like to see that prepared. And he thinks we're loading much too much in terms of the military. I mean, not only are they asked to fight, they're asked to be diplomats and mayors and ambassadors and engineers and social workers. And he says you can't load everything on the military. Some of these functions belong to the State Department. What do you think? 614-292-8513. Other issues as well. New poll by the Washington Post. About 3 Americans in 10 admit to racial bias. Well, that's pretty good. I mean it's awful, but at the same time, I think the poll some time ago would show many more admitting to a racial bias. Of course, you could also say if 3 admit to a racial bias, how many more have a racial bias? What's very interesting that the Washington Post poll found out that there's an overwhelming public openness to the idea of electing an African-American to the presidency. Nearly 9 in 10 white people in America say they would be comfortable with a black president. I mean, this was a poll, that particular question was asked a month ago. This was not a poll testing whether Barack Obama would be their choice, but rather, would you as a white person be comfortable with an African-American in the presidency? Nearly 9 in 10 whites said they would be comfortable with that. Fewer whites, however, about 2/3 of that amount, said they would be entirely comfortable with an African-American in the Oval Office. And that was more than double the percentage of all adults who said they would be so at ease with someone entering office for the first time at age 72. Of course, Senator McCain of Arizona would be so if he prevailed in November. Fewer than would be comfortable, again, very comfortable with Senator McCain or somebody age 72 entering office. Well, even so, according to the poll, just over half of whites in the new poll called Senator, in the new poll now, as opposed to the one a month ago, the new poll called Senator Obama a risky choice for the White House, while two-thirds said Senator McCain is a safe pick. You know, the polls are all over the place. A Newsweek poll just out gives Barack Obama a 15-point lead over John McCain. But in the Washington Post ABC poll, when they ask those most likely to vote, the contest is a toss-up, with Senator McCain at 48%, Senator Obama at 47%. So the polls are all over the place. Maybe we need a little break from the campaign here, you know, just before we move on. It was a long haul there with Senators Clinton and Obama, and maybe Senator McCain's idea of a dozen of these conferences, of these town meetings through the summer, was a little too much too soon. Maybe an idea like that would work better a little later, as Susan Jacoby suggested in the first hour, because maybe we're a little exhausted with the presidential campaign and we need a break. And of course, some people probably haven't begun looking at the presidential campaign yet and really haven't been tuning in. Well, you know, we have the gas prices moving up, and in the last couple of days in a meeting, Saudi Arabia said they would raise oil production just a bit. Other OPEC countries did not agree to do that. So the price of oil is going to be just about the same. There are all kinds of plans for doing something about this. Senator McCain said he wanted a summer break from the federal taxation on gas at the pump. Senator Obama says that's not a very good idea. It's not going to really get anywhere. Senator Obama said he wouldn't mind plumping for a windfall tax on oil company profits. Senator McCain originally supported such an idea some time ago, but he says now he does not think that's a good idea. We have rising expenses all over the place, a possible 50% increase in natural gas prices for heating our homes this winter. We've got an economic problem on our hands. Something like only about 14% of Americans in a recent Washington Post poll said America was headed in the right direction. The rest said it wasn't, or they weren't sure. If you think America is not headed in the right direction, or if you think America is headed in the right direction, whatever that question means to you, it's kind of an open question what that means. Give us a call here and tell me why you think America is headed in the right direction, or why you think America is headed in the wrong direction. And along what lines? Are we talking economic? Are we talking about our image in the world? Are we talking about warfare and peacemaking? If America is headed in the wrong or right direction, why do you think it's headed in that direction? 614-292-8513. We have an open line for you. You can email a comment or question to openline@wosu.org. Arnie joins us. Hello, Arnie.
How are you, Fred?
We're good.
All your suggested topics are wonderful, but, you know, I want to get down to the local level.
Okay.
We have a major entity here in Ohio is demanding that it be given the same kind of taxation breaks as a new new entity enters town.
All right.
And I'm not going to tell you the name that it was, but I think the in the newspaper it was called Schottenstein, who they're relocating from the south side to another place within the city of Columbus, and they want a the same kind of tax rebate as if we had attracted
a brand new company to the area.
Company.
Okay. Yeah.
And my question is it. Where are we? What are we doing? What are we doing to ourselves? I mean, that company should not even begin to ask. Sure, they might threaten to put it into a place like Gahanna or one of the other nearby cities. On the other hand, if that were reciprocal, and it happened as each city had to provide these tax breaks to an existing company that really doesn't need it, and I just like I can't even formulate a question on this.
Well, 2 points maybe. First of all, with this request, as with every other request, Columbus City Council will have to decide whether that's, a plus for the City of Columbus to grant such a request. But without speaking about this particular request, but in general, requests around the country, companies both newly locating and maybe those already located have come to cities and townships and entities and counties and said, look, if you want us to stay or if you want us to locate here, you got to give us certain tax breaks. And, some companies have played off one city entity against another municipality. It's a problem for cities. They don't want to lose jobs, right? And yet, on the other hand, they might not want to give the tax break. And so it's always a difficult question.
Yeah, well, I think that they were better on their philanthropy. They had the shot right there on campus, which came out of their pocket. So my guess is that they would really like to stay, but it really bugs me that they tried to do that. They want to stay here, but they want the tax break nevertheless, and that in turn. Causes other problems, to wit, that every other company wants the same kind of thing to take place.
So if you were Columbus City Council, what would you do in terms of the Schottenstein request, and what would you do in terms of general policy?
Well, I think that my view would be that if you're staying in the same venue within the city limits of the City of Columbus, We're not going to subsidize you in any way, manner, shape, or form.
What if a company comes from outside the state and says, we'll locate here if you give us certain tax advantages?
Well, that's fine, because they have never been here before, and that's one good way to entice them. We in the United States try to entice all over. It's not only in Columbus. We try to do that to everybody, but simply because you want to go into new digs doesn't mean that you should get a tax break. I'm voting against. If I were on the city council right now, I would vote against that tax break.
Arnie, thanks for your call.
Okay.
We're having it up at forum 614-292-8513. If you're more than one of the 80% of Americans who think America is headed in the wrong direction, call in and tell me why. On the other hand, if you're the 14%, you're among that number who think America is headed in the right direction, tell me why as well. 614-292-8513. You can email your comment or question to openline@wosu.org. Lee is on the line. Hi, Lee.
Hi, Fred. This is going to sound superficial and insignificant, but Barack Obama has no African slave blood running through his veins, and to me, he's more of a foreigner than they keep saying he's African American. I don't see it as that, and I think the African Americans have just taken leave of their senses.
Lee, where does Senator Obama fall short in terms of being an African? He's an American citizen. He's certainly black. Doesn't that make him an African American?
In a sense, it does, but in a sense, it does not. He has an African father and a white mother. The African Americans here have slave blood running through their history. He has none of that.
So how does that influence your feeling about the potential of voting for him for president?
Well, I originally wanted Hillary, but this country seems to want, the young people seem to want Obama, so that's their direction. So I have no other choice, but I'm not deluded into knowing that I think white Americans would accept. I don't think they would accept a black American that had African blood running through their veins. Mm. Slave blood running through their veins.
You don't think white Americans would accept
that? I don't think so.
Why not? Why do you think?
Because when I was growing up, if you dated a white person, they would say, oh, if you say that you're West Indian or you're from another country, my parents would accept you better. So I think this is an indication that they accept foreigners more than they accept their own.
Are you talking Americans
with slave blood running through their...
In this case, Leah, you're talking about white Americans or black Americans?
I'm talking about white Americans.
Yes, in other words, white Americans are more likely, you think, to accept somebody who says, oh, well, you know, I'm African. I was born abroad. I've moved here. I'm Jamaican, you know, and think more kindly of them or more highly of them than they would an African American who had slave blood.
Right, and I'm still trying to figure that out, but that's the way it goes.
Well, Lee, thanks for your call.
Okay, thank you.
All right, and let us go here to Greg. Hello, Greg, you're on the air.
Hi. My question is, we've heard a lot of polls talking about are white people accepting of a black president and prejudice against black people. Mm-hmm. Have we done any polls on how racist black people are against white people?
Well, I think there have been such polls. I don't recall any recently. I think for the most part, the real issue of racism in America resides in the hearts and minds of white people, not black people. What do you think?
Well, just thinking about Reverend Wright's sermon and all the stuff that stirred up, it was obviously racist against white people, and that seems to be okay.
Well, I don't. I of course, as you know, Senator Obama did renounced some of the things that the Reverend Wright suggested in his sermon, and I think all of us would. In terms of how are you defining racism now? I mean, what do you mean by that?
Just a negative view of somebody because of their race.
Okay, negative view because of their skin color or because of their race. So you're wondering how many African Americans have a negative view of white people simply because they are white. I mean, aside from any history, aside from the history of enslavement, lack of opportunity, et cetera, putting that aside, right?
Exactly.
Well, Greg, I don't know the answer to that. Maybe some of our African-American callers could call in and give us a bit of a sense, but I've not seen polling data on that. I think there have been, but I can't call it to mind. I don't think it's a bad question. I'm sure there are some African-Americans who don't like people because they're white. I mean, yeah, after all, that kind of racism is endemic in the human condition, I would suggest.
Correct.
But don't you think the major problem with racism in the United States is with white people?
I'm not so sure anymore. I know a lot of black people. I don't really see them as black or white. But I'm not sure anymore, to be honest with you.
I don't sense in my context with African-American people, you know, the kind of I don't hear the kinds of remarks. I don't sense the kind of hatred that I sometimes hear with my fellow whites directed at African Americans. I mean, in fact, if anything, gee, considering the history of oppression here of African Americans, I think they've been very gracious overall. What do you think?
They've been gracious, we've been gracious, and it's time to move on from that.
Well, I agree with you there. It's certainly time to move on. I mean, from all these attitudes, it's time to think of each other. As Dr. Martin Luther King said, you know, we want to look at each other, not based on the color of our skin, but on the content of our character. It is certainly time to move on, right?
Absolutely. I certainly have no prejudice, but, you know, I hear all these things of the black community and the black this, the black that, and I'm just kind of tired of it. We're just all people.
Well,
and
I think
they're separating themselves more by doing that.
Well, I think the reason you hear so much about the black community this or the black community that, as you phrase it, is because, you know, there's continuing prejudice against African-American people, prejudice in hiring and employment, even prejudice in terms we know in terms of racial profiling by some police departments. If that wasn't going on, I don't think you would hear much about the black community, the white community, et cetera. It seems to me it's the actions of the white community, for the most part, that are causing this kind of emphasis to be necessary. What do you think?
10 years ago, I would have agreed with you, but, you know, I must lead a little sheltered life because, you know, I don't witness it that much.
Mm-hmm. Well, your friends and acquaintances may be among those people who do not have these kinds of prejudices and would not act on them, right?
That's correct.
Uh-huh. Well, I would say make no mistake about it. There are people indeed. Well, I'm going to cite the guy. I mean, this is a public example. When Governor Strickland was running against Ken Blackwell, our then Secretary of State, of course, as you know, African-American.
Right.
And I've cited this example before, but there was a rally in southern Ohio for Governor Strickland, then candidate Strickland, and a 70-year-old white guy gets up and says, I'm going to vote for Governor Strickland. I'm a lifelong Republican. This is the first Democrat I've ever voted for, and there's a big cheer and everything because everybody took that at face value. Afterwards, Joe Hallett for the Dispatch sought him out and said, well, why, 70 years old, for the first time in your life, you're voting for a Democrat. Why? And this fellow said, I've never voted for a colored fella, and I'm not going to vote for one now. I'm sure that's not the kind of support that Governor Strickland would have welcomed, but that's the kind of the support he got from this guy. So, you know, it's out there.
I know. I had the pleasure of meeting a man. His name's Jim. He came from Baltimore, Maryland. He's black. And when he moved here, he was prejudiced against white people, and he didn't know anybody. I introduced him to some of my friends, white women who were married to black guys, and they adopted him, and all of my friends adopted him like a dad. And, you know, he was telling me about how he'd gotten over that prejudice.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Okay.
I'm still tired of hearing the black thing against whites.
Well, again, I would say you wouldn't be hearing it if the discrimination didn't exist. There'd be no reason to talk. I think the same thing is true of the gay community. You hear about gay rights. And I think you wouldn't hear so much about that if people were not prejudiced against them, and if rights were not denied. I mean, I think that's the basis of, you know, we'd like everybody to just say, well, we're all Americans, right? And
right.
Not have to talk about these divisions. But I think divisions often come up, and statements are often made because of a denial of rights. And I think that's where you get the problem. Hey, thanks, Greg. Thanks for your call.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
Right. And Chris is next. Hello, Chris.
Hi. Yeah, you were just talking about what's wrong with America. If I'm one of the people that think it is going downhill or not.
Yeah.
I think we're going down the wrong direction. I think one of the main things is just the disparity between, you know, the classes. I mean, the widening gap, the disappearance of the middle class, which I think can be attributed to just corporate greed, as far as I'm concerned. And I think that when you take out that economic base for that, you know, the pursuit of happiness, so to speak, and all that, and the majority of the population feels the economic pressures of, you know, an ever-aging, you know, our parents are living longer, and then we've got retirement to think about, the whole health insurance thing. I think the things have gone a little bit extreme the other direction. I'm not saying, you know, everybody should be one class, but there is a threshold or a limit that we should put on that, I think.
Well, Chris, I think when people are upset economically and have economic fears, yeah, that's a primary reason for somebody saying the country's moving in the wrong direction. And my gosh, it's not just gasoline at the pump. I mean, many middle-class people are kind of able to absorb those increased prices for gas at the pump. But some are not. If you do a lot of driving, you can't. And if you're working poor and making $8 an hour, you really can't absorb it. But then look at the natural gas moving upward here. The price of homes is declining. So if you wanted to sell your home, you might not be able to sell it at all. You might not be able to sell it at a profit. So I think you're right that economic worries are certainly one reason why many people are saying, look, you know, we're headed in the wrong direction. Yeah.
Yeah, I think when you have those kind of pressures, it's hard to address other issues. If we've got all these fundamental survival things, you know, like just your basic how you're going to live day to day, how are you going to pay attention to the bigger social issues?
Sure. Oh, it makes it very difficult. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, that's, you know, either that or once again, you know, the poverty thing comes up and people handle that in a variety of different ways. And, you know, a lot of times, too, these issues of racism and stuff like that get exacerbated by hard times. I mean, it seems like we channel our energy in a lot of weird directions when those kind of things come about. And I just think that there could be a little more, I don't know, a little more accountability or return on the part of these corporations when they're literally, you know, they're moving their shops offshore and paying people, hopefully even a living wage in their own communities. That's whatever. But if they're still basically making the majority of their astronomical profits off the American people, then, you know, maybe there should be some other return into that community as well.
Well, what do you think, if that is the case, what do you think an American president, the next president, could do about some of this?
Well, they'd have to actually ask somebody a lot smarter than me to come up with an actual, you know, feasible, workable idea. But I would say that if technically you're supposed to be an American company and, you know, you have all your operations offshore, then it's just, and you're just basically fleecing the people and just making astronomical profits, I would think there should be some kind of weird tax. You know, but if you move your operations back onshore, you get a lot bigger tax break because you're creating jobs, and that way you're funneling money back into the community.
There was a while back one third party presidential candidate, can't even remember his name. He was a tiny party, never got any traction. Had the idea of big tax incentives to keep, in other words, he said, make it so attractive for an American corporation to stay here that they wouldn't think of going overseas.
Yeah, I mean, they're basically going to make these huge profits one way or the other, and we're not getting much of that tax anyway. Or, you know, probably if we are, then it's not really channeling back into the community the way of jobs or anything like that. I mean, I personally would like to see lower the taxes on these guys. That way, they're happy, creates jobs, makes us happy. That's good. I don't know the consequences of that. Like I said, somebody much smarter than me would know all the ins and outs and exactly how to put something in place. I just see these guys just getting away with a lot. And, you know, there's hardly anybody I know that's just totally solid about their future. I mean, nobody's really comfortable the way they were. I mean, they don't even trust their 401ks. Mm. You know what I mean? It's like they look at it out of the corner of their eye. Pensions are unheard of. You know, so the future on that end is just way up in the air.
Well, Chris, we're almost out of time. Got to move on, but I appreciate your call.
Hey, Fred, real quick, if you could tell us a little bit more about this poetry book you got coming out.
Oh, okay. I'll save that for another time, but I will. We've got a book of poetry coming out in September, XOXOS Press up in Gambier, and when it's ready, you'll know more about it.
Okay, great.
Thanks for asking. Okay.
Right.
Mary is on the line. Hi, Mary. Just got about 2 minutes here. Sorry we can't get to everybody today.
I'll limit to my definition, racism. There cannot be black racism in the United States of America. Racism is based on systems of power. Black people who were captured and brought here as slaves have never had power. They cannot be black racist. They can certainly have their bigotry and their prejudices. But we got to recognize that racism is an economic system. It started out as an economic system. It denigrates a group of people easily identified. They've been controlled. My great-grandfather was a slave owner. It's going to take generations of intense commitment and study to even begin to attack the vestiges of a racist system. The signers of the Declaration of Independence owned slaves. This thing of being tired of the black thing is just an indication that recent education has dealt very badly with the whole subject of the origin of America as a racist country. I thank you for the time.
Mary,
you've had two great guests this morning.
Can I ask you one question here? So you would make a distinction in your definition between racism, which you say is a system, a power system, used to oppress others, but you would say an African-American person could be bigoted or prejudiced against white people. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So
certainly, from their past experience, they meet it every day. I just can't imagine how black people can even speak. I have a neighbor who speaks nicely to me every day, and I think, how can he have overcome the experiences he's had to be able to speak nicely to one more white person? Hmm. It's an amazing triumph of spirit and humanity that they can do that.
Well, Mary, we're out of time, and I thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Thanks
for the
everybody.
Bye-bye.
Thanks to Susan Jacoby today and Senator Chuck Hagel of Nebraska for being with us, and to all of you who called in the open forum. And listeners supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from the Donald R. Glancy Endowed Fund, a legacy of commitment to great programming on WOSU Public Media.